I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Today is an exciting episode for me because I have long had an interest in the Dutch presence in North America, particularly ever since reading our guest's book back, I think, in 2005 when I first encountered it, The Island at the Center of the World. It's a fantastic book about the Dutch colony of New Amsterdam. And we are joined today by the world's leading authority on that colony and its significance in the rest of American history and the development of America. And that our guest today is Russell Shorto. Russell is an author, historian, journalist. He is a senior scholar at the New Netherland Institute, also director of the New Amsterdam Project. That's at the New York Historical Society.
That's right.
And curating a very interesting new exhibit in New York City. Russell, for our listeners who might be in the New York area or journeying there, what's this new exhibit going to be?
Well, it'll be opening May 1st of next year and running through the summer, through the spring and summer. It's going to be called Old Masters and New Amsterdam. And the notion is New Amsterdam, the Dutch who founded the colony, wrote a lot, but there were not many artists in the colony, so we don't have much of a sense of what it looked like. However, the old masters, Rembrandt and his contemporaries, were painting up a storm, and they were, you know, casting their eye to the world around them and painting tavern scenes and market scenes and interiors of homes. And so we're using their works to get a sense of what New Amsterdam may have looked like.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating exhibit, and I encourage all our listeners who are in the area to get there and participate. But today, of course, our conversation is about Russell's most recent book. It's a terrific read, like all of his books. Combines deep historical research and new interesting archival research with the ability to write a page turner. And it's a rare combination among historians. I appreciate it. Today, our conversation is about his book, Taking Manhattan, The Extraordinary Events That Created New York and Shaped America. Russell Du, thanks again for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thanks very much for having me, Jeff. And I know a couple of historians who would dispute your calling me the undisputed expert on all things New Amsterdam, but thanks.
At least for this person.
Okay.
Well, of course, our audience is fairly well informed historically. But there is this interesting moment in thinking about the history of New York City and broadly, more broadly, America. Before there was New York, there was New Amsterdam. For our listeners, how did New Amsterdam come to be?
The Dutch wanted to establish a settlement in North America, a colony. Initially, their goals, I mean, nobody looks, you know, hundreds of years into the future, or not many people do. Their goals initially were to have a base from which to trade with the native people for furs. That was a prime income stream, at least in their minds. And they were, the Dutch in the 17th century at this time, they were, through their big multinational corporations, the West India Company and the East India Company, they were exploiting the world. The East India Company had made all these profits that came funneling into the home country from the East Indies, that is to say, Asia, silks, spices. They were the only European nation that traded with Japan. And the West India Company was formed to do the same thing with what was then called the West Indies, meaning if you're in Europe looking at a map, everything to your left. So coastal North America, the Caribbean, and coastal South America. And New Netherland, as the colony itself was called, was part of that.
And remind us again, you alluded to it, but remind us of the relative position of the Dutch in the world at the time among, for example, European powers. What are they relative, for example, to the English?
They were, of course, among other European nations, they're a tiny little slip of a country. And yet they had, in the space of a few decades, just bewildered their European neighbors by becoming probably the most powerful trading and colonizing nation in the world. They did that by exploiting, for one thing, the intolerance was of religious intolerance was official policy in Europe and common sense. So it's a dangerous world, and in order to get ahead and preserve your integrity, you had to stay on the same page. And religion, everybody knew, was a very divisive force. So you had a state church, and you tried to push out others, and that was the policy in England, in France, in Spain. The Netherlands turned that on its head, and they had an official policy of religious toleration. And because of that, it was an unusually, Amsterdam was an unusually mixed, multi-ethnic, multilingual city. And because of that, they turned that idea around that would cause chaos. And instead, you know, it showed that if you have this kind of way of looking at things, then you're open to other places, to other ideas, speaking other languages, and it's basically good for business.
And out of that kind of business enterprising character, free, open character, as you say, they found New Netherland in the United States, particularly New Amsterdam. For our listeners, what year is it founded, and what kind of a start does it get off to?
The backstory of it is in 1609, an Englishman, Henry Hudson, is hired by the Dutch East India Company, and he charts. He was actually hired to look for a short route to Asia. He runs into North America, and he charts this whole section of the eastern seaboard, and then he goes back and says, "I couldn't find Asia that way," but Since he scoped out all this territory on behalf of the Dutch, they laid claim to it. That's 1609. Then it's not until 1624 that they begin to make good on that, and they begin to send settlers to this colony. And 2 years later, in 1626, a capital of New Amsterdam is founded at the southern tip of Manhattan Island.
For 40 years or so, it continues as a Dutch colony. Obviously, a very important moment. Your book seems to chronicle extraordinarily important events and moments in the creation of New Amsterdam, and then the transition, of course, to New York. 1664 is a critical moment in your book, but there are decades between the founding in the 1620s and 1664. What's life like in early New Amsterdam?
They founded in 1624, and so the colony, as a Dutch colony, has a lifespan of 40 years before it becomes New York. It starts off very primitive, but it slowly builds. And this aforementioned notions of I guess what we would call capitalism, though the word didn't exist yet, and toleration. Together make it this unusual place that starts to intrigue first the English to the north and the south. The Puritan colonies of New England are founded around the same time, and there are English settlements to the south in Maryland and Virginia. But you know, this Dutch colony is not just Manhattan. It encompassed all or parts of New York, New Jersey, some of Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Connecticut. So it becomes this vibrant place in which everybody is a trader. Famously, at one point, it's reported that there are 18 languages being spoken in New Amsterdam. So as I like to say, New York was New York even before it was New York. Every one of these people is a trader, and they all have their own networks. Some of them are trading with different specific islands in the Caribbean, with coastal South America, with different parts of Europe. So this mix, this blend, makes it quite a dynamic place and slowly attracts English interest.
At this time, is there any connection, commercial or otherwise, between the English colonies in North America and New Amsterdam?
Oh, sure. They were very, you know, we tend to think back then, you know, you couldn't get in a car or an airplane, and so you didn't know what was going on. They were very aware of their position in the world. All of these colonists were. They wrote letters home, even though it took 6 or 8 weeks to get there, and then at least 6 or 8 weeks to get back to get an answer. So they were up on, at least as up as you can be, on events at home. And they communicated very regularly with the English in New England. And the English in New England soon discovered, and in Virginia, discovered that they could do business with the Dutch, and that they, for one thing, the Dutch could ship their products home, so that from Virginia, they found it was lower cost and more straightforward to ship products to New Amsterdam and then have them ship them to Europe than to try to do it themselves.
Is this a period of relative goodwill between the Netherlands and England, or is this colonial cooperation and commerce sort of contrary to the general relations between the two powers at the time?
Yeah, no, I would not call it a period of goodwill. Throughout the 17th century, they're both building empires. The English are later in the empire building game than the Dutch. And the English are very envious of the Dutch and this power that they had wielded. One indication of that is the series of slurs that came into the English language with the word Dutch in them. You know, Dutch treat, Dutch uncle, going Dutch.
Oh, yes.
All these date to, in the 17th century, before newspapers, there were pamphlets that were printed on the fly, and that's how people got news of whatever, you know, some rival nation was doing or whatever. And all those slurs date from these pamphlets of the 1600s. So, no, there were not terribly friendly relations overall, although there were, I mean, business was done and there was a lot of exchange back and forth. People went from England to the Netherlands and back, and from the English colonies to the Dutch colony. It becomes a complicated picture when you imagine a certain amount of enmity, but at the same time, there's a great deal of interest. And I often say that England and the Dutch Republic in the 17th century were kind of like siblings who grow up envious, fighting at times, but having a lot in common too.
Did they have similar plans for their New World colonies? So when the English looked at the New World, did they have the same sort of thing in mind that the Dutch had? Or were they differently disposed toward what they wanted out of North America?
Yeah, they were different. I mean, in neither case is it clear cut. The English colonies of New England were mostly established by the Puritans in England. And to talk about the Puritans is to talk about the whole fraught situation that England was in the 17th century, where their society became bitterly divided between the Puritans and everybody else. So in the English Civil War, the two sides are thought of as the Puritans and the Royalists. Royalists, I think it's better to use a term like anti-Puritan. So the Puritans wanted to, as the name suggests, purify the Church of England. The head of the Church of England was the king. The Puritans thought the church was corrupt, therefore the monarchy is corrupt, all of society is corrupt. They have to take charge and do God's will and do things like outlaw Christmas and dancing and theater and things like that. The people who opposed them was, you know, they had a variety of reasons. So the Puritans are one faction that found these colonies in New England. The Dutch. So in terms of what they were doing, on the one hand, there was some sort of underlying religious motivation, which America took in as part of its DNA. You know, the idea that God is favoring this project, favoring this continent, giving these English the continent, and eventually the right to spread all the way across to the Pacific Ocean. On the Dutch side, as I said, they the Dutch West India Company, it was a business venture. They wanted to do business. They wanted to do business with native people. The West India Company very quickly had to give up its monopoly because it just couldn't make a go of it. So then you have all sorts of private concerns. So private trading companies, the owner of a company in Amsterdam would send one of his sons to New Amsterdam to open a branch office. So they were, you know, trying to figure out, okay, how can we make a go of this? And as I said earlier, they were then looking for business opportunities, looking to the Caribbean, looking, we got a lot of timber here. We're gonna, you know, export timber. There's salt to be had in the Caribbean. We're gonna ship salt. So in the records, you see them constant, like shipping of different things coming in, different things going out. European manufactured goods are coming in. So it's a complicated project of building a colony, building a home.
So you get, by the time you get to 1664, which again is a pivotal moment in your book, you have what some people have described, and I don't know if you would agree with this description, but the first modern city in New Amsterdam.
I think there's a case to be made for that, because it was not dependent on a monarchy. It was not dependent on a church. It was dependent on, I think, what we would say are the forces of capitalism to some extent. There was always tension between these different forces. As I said, the West India Company administered it. And so it, even though it broke down the monopoly and allowed other traders to come in, it claimed the right to sort of set the parameters, and there was always tension between the colonists and the colony in terms of what was the best way to move the place forward.
One of the themes in your book is also, of course, that Manhattan and New Amsterdam are started in part on land that did not belong to the Dutch, of course, Native Americans.
Sure. Yeah, I'm glad you...
If the Dutch were famously liberal, at least compared to the rest of Europe, were they famously liberal in their relations with the native peoples?
I'm glad you raised this, because when I talk about tolerance and Dutch toleration, I think it's a real thing, and I believe you need to acknowledge that. It's also a very limited thing, and you need to acknowledge that. Maybe most notably, a year after New Amsterdam was founded, the first enslaved Africans arrived. Slavery was never a big thing in the colony until the very end, not because the Dutch were, you know, too noble for that or anything, but it just wasn't part of. I mean, you didn't need enslaved labor to do the kind of work that they had in mind, and yet there were enslaved people throughout the whole life of the colony, and the numbers grew. And with regard to the native people, it's a long and complicated story. They were not there to try to push them away or exterminate them. They were there to trade with them. And it needs to be said that it was a two-way street. The native people saw something in this relationship. They valued manufactured goods from Europe, knives and kettles and muskets, and so they wanted this relationship. The Dutch were not trappers, so the foundation of the place was the native people would trap animals and trade the furs to them, and then they would ship them to Europe. That worked, except when it didn't. There are a number of instances in the life of the colony where, you know, it's always hard to get to the root of the conflict, but something happens. And then there's the reprisal, and then there's a counter, and then it either is quelled or it blows up into a full-scale war, such as in the 1640s, what's called Kieft's War, where the Dutch did horrific things, massacring two whole villages. And then eventually there's a treaty, And then they try to carry on business again. You have colonists like Adrian Vanderdonk, who wrote a book called A Description of New Netherland, which gives us the fullest account of what life was like in the colony. And he talks about different native groups. Of course, you know, we're talking about many different tribes speaking different languages from one another, having different cultures. He kind of gives a primer, outlines these different groups and what they're like, tries to describe things like how women give birth, what their belief system is, how their languages work, you know, how they conjugate their verbs, things like that. So you have people who are trying to take a nuanced view, and then you have these complete breakdowns.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
One of the things you also talk about in the book is the politics internal to the colony. And the rise of someone like Peter Stuyvesant becomes, of course, a very important figure in New Amsterdam, and then, of course, now still remembered in New York City. Can you talk us a little bit about the internal politics, the rise of Stuyvesant, as we get toward 1664?
Yeah, they had a number of different directors of the colony who were employees of the Dutch West India Company. And Stuyvesant was the last and the most effective of them. He came in 1647, and he was the one who was there at the end and had to grapple with this English incursion in 1664. So he was there for 17 years. And I think he ought to be given credit for developing New Amsterdam as this very successful, very savvy trading port. A colleague of mine at the New Netherland Institute, Dennis Micah, has been writing about the merchants of New Amsterdam and how, largely under Stuyvesant's management, this place and its traders developed this unique way of doing business, which became then, once the English took over, New York's foundation as a business center. And it's not an accident that Wall Street was the northern boundary of the city, and then Wall Street became synonymous with American finance. So Stuyvesant is a pivotal figure. He's a complicated figure. So on the one hand, he has to be given credit for that. On the other hand, he is the one, more than anyone else in the colony, who very late in the day establishes the basis of what becomes then a real influx of enslaved Africans into the colony. And then the English kind of inherit that, and then they build it, and New York becomes a big slaving town.
The book tells once Stuyvesant, of course, is in charge and 1664 comes, the events of the English-led incursion there, and the kind of what my reading from the book is, the unexpected twist and turn things took in that moment. Tell us about what happens in 1664.
Yeah, so 2 weeks in the late summer of 1664, the Dutch have this quite successful little colony, which, however, has not been fully supported by the West India Company, which is busy with other areas where they are making a profit. They've not been able to make a profit here. In England, meanwhile, you have the aforementioned civil war. The Puritans take over. They behead the king. His two young sons flee into exile on the continent. Eventually, they come back onto the throne. And when they do, they want to begin building a trading empire the way the Dutch have. They look across the Atlantic and they see this landscape, and they see the Dutch with what they now realize is this prime real estate. And they appoint a man whom they have known all their lives, named Richard Nichols, to head an expedition. Four ships, 450 soldiers, the ships packed to the gills with gunpowder and weapons. The Dutch and English have not long ago fought a war, a trade war. So all indications are Nichols is going to lead this force and open fire and lay waste and try to take the colony by force. He sails into the harbor, but instead of going right at New Amsterdam, at the town, and bombing it, he pulls into harbor at Gravesend, at the little community of Gravesend. The Dutch had not just New Amsterdam, they had settlements all around what is now New York City, which were ethnically mixed because that's who they were. But this one, Gravesend, was almost completely an English settlement within the Dutch colony. Richard Nichols knew that, and he knew this was safe territory for him. So he made that his base. And from there, he sends a boat with messengers to New Amsterdam. They deliver a message to Stuyvesant. Stuyvesant reads it, thinks about it, composes a reply, sends messengers back. And so this is what goes on. And really, the center of the book and the story I tell is of this discussion, this negotiation, where both of them are really interesting people who you can see them thinking. You can feel them thinking this out. You can feel Nichols saying, yes, I can, you know, I've got more soldiers and more weapons. I can take this place. But he has learned that the Dutch have done something really special. And if he just levels the place, he'll have the island of Manhattan, but that's it. Whereas if he can figure out a way to make these people happy, these people who've been doing business with all parts of the world, and let it continue, then he will have this really successful, very interesting city, and he'll have it as an English city. So that's what he wants. Stuyvesant and his population, really, because everybody was part of this discussion, everybody in town, they all know that the Dutch West India Company had not supported them, had not supported their colony. They were not sending soldiers. They weren't sending more settlers. And they all know that, you know, the continent lays before them, and it's ripe for the taking, for exploiting. So ultimately, what I think Stuyvesant does is he decides that he has a loyalty to the Dutch government, he has a loyalty to the Dutch West India Company, but finally he decides that his greater loyalty is to this place and these people, the people he has lived among for 17 years, where he and his wife Judith have raised their two sons. He feels very much that he himself developed this successful business culture. And he and his populace decide that the best way to preserve what they have is to sign it over to the English if they can get rights, if they can get assurance that they will continue. And that's what Nichols grants them in the so-called Articles of Surrender, in which nothing is surrendered except the colony itself. But they are promised, it's basically a Bill of Rights. They're able to keep their homes, their families, their trade networks. And so what I call it in the book is an invention. They have invented, it's a kind of merger. They've merged this Dutch base. They've merged it onto what is becoming this growing English empire. And that is basically how New York gets created.
when the English take over, do they honor that agreement or do they immediately start to try to make significant changes to New Amsterdam?
Both. Nichols, there's a point very early on where he starts to, you know, go off and do things. He's like, okay, I'm in charge of here. And by the way, Nichols becomes the first governor of New York. And then the Dutch literally come in waving the agreement, saying, wait a second, we have a deal here. And he says, oh, right, you're right, you're right. So he has to backpedal. And by and large, he does honor the agreement. He does a number of things where he sides with his colonists. And for example, in London, they decide, you know, because the English are in the larger global scheme, they are annoyed with the Dutch empire, a trading empire, and they decide they want to have what they call navigation laws restricting what kind of ships come into English ports with goods. They decide they have to be English ships. And Nichols, on behalf of his colony, says, no, we want them to allow Dutch ships because that will benefit our colony. That, you know, this is how that kind of open port, this free trade, is what this place, New Amsterdam, now New York, is founded on, and that's its success.
And what about the as the transition, as the English take over and eventually, of course, becomes integrated into British North America, what about the enduring significance of the Dutch and the Dutch colony there for New York City? Does it remain any significant as a stratum of society and enduring customs, traditions, practices, institutions, or is it pretty quickly overwhelmed and subsumed by Englishness?
No, it is a unique place because it was New Amsterdam. And I think to this day, I think that evidence is there, not so much in language, although language persists for a while and names, you know, everything from Harlem to Staten Island, which was Dutch named Long Island. This agreement, this Dutch foundation, which had in it this notion of religious toleration, the multi-ethnicity, a business port, a global entrepot, all of that becomes part of the dynamism, the unique energy of New York in colonial America, and that remains part of New York's success. Then when you jump ahead to, you know, the Dutch in the 1600s, one thing they saw was, okay, here's Manhattan Island, you follow for it up the Hudson River, and then you can follow the Mohawk River west all the way to the Great Lakes. So ultimately, they thought that was the way to the future because the rivers were the highways. But they couldn't navigate the whole Mohawk River. If you jump to the 1820s, when the Erie Canal is completed almost exactly 200 years ago, the Mohawk becomes navigable all the way to the Great Lakes. All the cities around the Great Lakes, I was just giving a talk in Buffalo, which is the terminus of the Erie Canal. That's when it becomes this powerhouse, as do Chicago and Detroit and Erie and Duluth and all those places. And that's when New York City really takes off as this fulcrum that pulls all the world's goods and people in and then allows them to go forward to populate the interior of the continent. In a way, the Dutch of the 1600s foresaw all of that happening. So all of later history, not just of New York City, but of America, I think relates back to that period.
And it's what was fascinating to me in part about your book and the enduring importance of the new Amsterdam colony, as you just saying there, is so much here is, of course, building on your previous work, but also many new insights, new archival material. There's a wealth of sources and resources here. Again, a lot of our listeners are, again, historically minded folks, some of whom are history teachers, history researchers. Can you tell us a little bit about your grappling with, finding, and working with this kind of archival material?
Sure. And since you give me that opening, I should point people who are interested to the New Netherland Institute. It's newnetherlandinstitute.org. A lot of the original primary source material translated is digitized and scanned on the website there. These are court cases, counsel minutes, correspondence. So you can sort of find your own way through a lot of that material. That is one body of material that I worked from. The other, on the English side, there are actually two main groups. One is at the UK Archives, National Archives, and the other is at Oxford University. And they together filled out the English pieces of this story. In particular, I used the person of Richard Nichols and his life, going back to his childhood, and how it turns out he knew the young princes and the young Charles who would become the king. They knew each other as children. They'd known each other all their lives, which explains, and no one had written about Nichols before, but that explains why they picked this guy on this, for this very important mission. So I was able, with those records, to follow Nichols and his life and use his life to tell the story of the turmoil in England throughout the whole 17th century and the civil wars and the ultimate resolution of the wars and the return of the monarchy, and how the story of New Netherland and New York fits into that.
It often seems to me when I'm talking with authors like yourself who have dug deep into this archival material and sort of telling a story that is inevitably filled with interesting, colorful, complex, maybe even contradictory characters, there's often something that's surprising to them. You know this history so well, maybe nothing surprises you anymore, but in writing this book, was there something that really surprised you?
Yeah, many things. In this interaction between Nichols and Stuyvesant and researching both of them, and Nichols, when he was in London, trying to get a handle on what this colony is that he's about to try to take, they had a number of mutual connections, one of them being John Winthrop Jr., the governor of Connecticut, another being Robert Murray, who was the first head of the Royal Society for the Advancement of Sciences in London. And this continued. So they were, while all this is going on, they're exchanging letters about, you know, this is the dawn of the age of science. And they're talking about different minerals in North America and strange birds and wind patterns. And Peter Stuyvesant is part of that conversation. You know, the idea that these people kind of connected at that level is fascinating.
It's amazing.
Another thing is that finding out that Nichols himself chose on the fly to name this city, once he took it in this colony, for his patron, James, the Duke of York. And he writes to him at one point and says, I gave this place the name of New York. So he's like, you know, I named it after you. Do you like, are you happy with that?
It's fascinating. It is true, as you suggest in the book, that, and you've already alluded to, but it does seem true to me, at least reading the book, that the dynamism of New York, as you were saying, that's really unleashed in the early 19th century, but sort of the enduring center place of New York as a center of capitalism and pluralism in America does seem to be traced back to the story that you tell in this book. Does that seem right?
I think that's true. And one thing that we didn't touch on is Nichols actually had two missions. One was to take this colony from the Dutch. The other was to deal with the English in New England, because the New England colonies, remember, were founded by the Puritans. They were the people who had beheaded the father of the current king. So there was no love lost between the king, the present king, and the Puritans based in Boston. So Nichols' second mission was figure out how to make them bow down to us. And in that, he failed, because the Boston Puritans had this very powerful little theocracy of their own. They were minting their own money, and they just rebuffed him. And because of that, if you kind of take a step back, these two missions of Richard Nichols, whom nobody even knows about, the one sets up this ideological power base in New York, which is the center of pluralism and capitalism and relatively outward looking. The other, based in Boston, would become the center of Puritanism, of kind of a Christian nationalism, which would lead to a kind of America First sensibility. And I think those two ideologies have always been part of the American story and have always been battling with each other. And I think any episode of American history you look at, you can see those two forces at work right up to where we are right now. And it just my humble opinion is that the country has always done best when it finds a way to keep them in balance. And when one of them becomes completely ascendant over the other, then things go haywire.
Well, this is a fascinating book. This is a fascinating story. For our listeners, our audience, again, the book, our guest is Russell Shorto. The wonderful new book just out is called Taking Manhattan, The Extraordinary Events That Created New York and Shaped America. Let me encourage all of you to go out and get it. It's terrific, sound, great, deeply researched history, but also just a terrific read. You are going to enjoy this book. Russell, thanks for taking the time to be with us on The American Idea.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.